طفلة تمتطي قوس قزح.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly 45-minute segment of news from Palestine and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's brutal military occupation and colonization of their homeland. This program presents news and analysis from the Palestinian perspective, a perspective we do not get from the mainstream media. We ask our listeners, as we do every week, were you involved last week in the Palestine-Israel peace movement and the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's savage military attacks against them to force them out of their homes and annex their properties into Israel? Did you speak out on the atrocities Israel is committing every day in Gaza and the West Bank? If not, why not? What is your reason not to?
Well, we're still trying to establish an overseas phone call, so please do bear with us. In the meanwhile, we're going to listen to a short presentation from Al Jazeera English.
The White House has condemned Israel's plan to build hundreds of new settlements in the West Bank, saying it will make peace negotiations more difficult. Friday's unusually sharp rebuke came as a group of West Bank villagers held their weekly protest against the Israeli separation barrier that is built on their stolen land. Al Jazeera's Jackie Rowland visited the village, and she filed this report.
Despite the heat, despite the Ramadan fast, they come in their hundreds. This is the scene every Friday. The people of Bilayn make a short but symbolic march to the separation wall that Israel has built on their land. Waiting for them on the other side of the barbed wire, the Israeli army, and the soldiers don't hold back. A non-violent protest meets a violent response. Bombarded with tear gas, then soaked in a stinking green liquid that clings to the skin for days. The price the villagers pay for demanding the return of their stolen lands. So this is how Bilayn has become known, through these pictures of protesters, some of them wounded, all of us tear gassed, in this uneven confrontation between the Israeli army and the people of Bilayn and their supporters. But there are other, less seen images that show just how far the Israelis are willing to go in their efforts to crush this resistance. The Israeli army has started raiding the village by night. These visits are frequent and brutal. They're looking for people they believe are involved in the weekly protests. Sometimes the soldiers drag villagers from their beds and take them away for questioning.
Why is getting arrested?
Mohammed Khatib knows all about the 4 a.m. knock on the door. He was detained and held in an Israeli jail for 2 weeks. In the end, he was released, but only on condition that he leaves Bilayn every Friday when the demonstration is taking place.
Bilayn became a symbol of the nonviolent resistance. So now we are paying the price of that by the Israelis take a decision, a political decision, to arrest the leaders of this campaign, of this struggle, and also they want to stop it.
This barrier of steel and concrete and the occupation it represents are illegal under international law. Even the Israeli Supreme Court has ruled that building the wall on the lands of Bilayn is illegal. But the barrier remains, the army guards it, and the struggle goes on. Jackie Rowland, Al Jazeera, Bilayn.
It is Sunday, September 6th, 2009. We begin with a summary of news highlights and what they mean. Last week, we got an indication of Prime Minister Netanyahu's intentions to continue Israel's brutal military rule over Palestine when he appointed the soon-to-be-promoted Major General Eitan Dangot as the supreme ruler of Palestine. From now on, nothing can go on in Palestine without his approval. No construction, no economic activity, no services, no travel between towns and cities, no education or health care, without the approval of the military overlord. Meanwhile, Fatah-appointed Palestinian Prime Minister Salam Fayyad issued his plan for an independent state of Palestine. The plan is rich in high-sounding principles of justice and equality and in detailed descriptions of ministries and their functions, but significantly sketchy in treating the two most important issues with which there can be no peace: the dismantling of all settlements and the right of return of Palestinian refugees. On Tuesday, 25th August, Prime Minister Fayyad announced his intention of bypassing the failed peace process and establish a de facto state of Palestine within 2 years. He said that, quote, if a functioning de facto state existed, with or without Israeli cooperation, including competent security forces, functioning public services, and a thriving economy, it would force Israel to put its cards on her table as to whether it was serious about ending the 42-year occupation of the West Bank. He hoped that this goal could be achieved by mid-2011. We ask, how exactly does Mr. Fayyad hope to develop a thriving economy without Israel's cooperation, when Israel can continue with impunity to use more than 600 choke points it has, propagandized in this country as security checkpoints, to immobilize Palestinian citizens, choke off all life and transportation out of the cities, and strangulate all forms of commerce? That has been the mission of those choke points from the beginning, and they have largely succeeded in eviscerating the Palestinian economy and all medical and other social services. Secondly, we ask, what commercial establishment or functioning public services can possibly exist when Israel, with impunity, can destroy any building it wishes and claim it is part of a terrorist infrastructure? Has Mr. Fayyad looked at the platform of the Likud party headed by Prime Minister Netanyahu? It says, among other things, with regard to the settlements, quote, the Jewish communities in Judea, Samaria, and Gaza are the realization of Zionist values. The Likud will continue to strengthen and develop these communities and prevent their uprooting. With regard to a Palestinian state, it says, quote, the government of Israel flatly rejects the establishment of a Palestinian Arab state west of the Jordan River. The Palestinians can run their lives freely in the framework of self-rule, but not as an independent and sovereign state, unquote. In addition, the Likud platform, which governs Mr. Netanyahu's policies, states that, quote, a unilateral Palestinian declaration of the establishment of a Palestinian state will constitute a fundamental and substantive violation of the agreements with the State of Israel and the scuttling of the Oslo and Y Accords. The government will adopt immediate stringent measures in the event of such a declaration, unquote. In other words, a de facto Palestinian state will trigger a violent Israeli reaction. Even if such a de facto state were to come into existence unscathed, what would it look like? Would it not merely be composed of the dozens of Bantustans with a wall and settlements as they exist today, and with Israel's military expulsion forces at every door? That such a de facto emerging state should be functional in any way defies the most extravagant imagination. According to Mr. Fayyad's own plan, the PA's Ministry of the Wall and Settlement Affairs would then, quote, launch media and political activities that highlight the International Court of Justice's advisory opinion on the wall, work to reaffirm United Nations resolutions regarding illegal settlements, and provide necessary support to popular committees in their peaceful resistance against the wall, unquote. Yeah, right. Neither Mr. Fayyad nor President Abbas has called for the dismantling of all settlements. Mr. Abbas merely said that he was not willing to engage in negotiations with Israel unless Israel unconditionally stopped all settlement construction. About existing settlements, Mr. Abbas said nothing. Although during the visit of the group of elders during the week of August 22nd to August 29th, former President Jimmy Carter appeared to call for the dismantling of all settlements, this contradicted an earlier statement he made when he visited the settlement block of Gush Etzion on June 14th, when he said that settlements near the Green Line would stay in Israel. On August 5th, United States Congressman Henry Waxman reflected the thinking in the United States Congress when he said that, quote, everybody recognizes that settlements built by Israel in the block areas will be part of Israel when there's a settlement for land. Prime Minister Netanyahu, who had agreed to a temporary freeze on settlement construction in return for United States backing of stringent sanctions on Iran, recently reneged on that agreement. On Friday, September 4th, Israel said it will construct hundreds of new housing units in West Bank settlements before any slowdown in building. Slowdown, mind you, not suspension or cessation of settlement building, just a slowdown. This has deeply embarrassed President Obama, who, The Guardian reported, was planning to formally unveil his so-called breakthrough peace plan at a meeting of world leaders at the United Nations General Assembly in New York in the week beginning September 23rd, or the G20 summit in Pittsburgh on the 24th and 25th of September. Mr. Obama has spent virtually all of his political capital fighting the financial meltdown around the globe and trying to pass health reform legislation in this country. The United States president has been reduced to a flailing giant pleading with Israel to honor its commitment. All of which leads us to ask the question that begs to be asked. Is there any reason at all, to believe or hope that a viable, independent, sovereign Palestinian state can be established with East Jerusalem as its capital? Today, we have the privilege of discussing this and the alternative solution of a single state with Dr. Ilan Pape, Professor of History at the University of Exeter in the United Kingdom and co-director of the Exeter Center for Ethnopolitical Studies. A prolific author, Professor Pape has written what are regarded as the most authoritative modern historical accounts of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, including Britain and the Arab-Israeli Conflict in 1988, A History of Modern Palestine, One Land, Two Peoples, in 2003, The Modern Middle East, in 2005, and perhaps his most widely read seminal book, The Ethnic Cleansing of Palestine, in 2006, which is highly recommended reading to all who are seriously interested in learning about the background which colors today's discussions about politically ending Israel's Zionist colonial project, either through a so-called two-state solution or through a one-state solution. Good afternoon, Professor Ilan Pape. Welcome back to This Week in Palestine.
Good afternoon. It's a pleasure to be again on your program, Sharif.
Thank you. Would it be fair to characterize the situation today in Israel and Palestine as the continuation of the Zionist colonial project?
Yes, I think it's a fair description. I think what changed with time is the territory in which the colonization efforts are taking place. We have to mention in this respect that it's not only the continued settlement, Jewish settlement in the West Bank that should attract our attention, but also the fact that there is a continued de-Arabization effort in the Galilee and in the Nakab, with the same method and with the same strategy that is taking place in wide areas of the West Bank.
Is there any realistic hope for a viable two-state solution?
No, I think that every passing day drives home the message very clear that this is an impossible solution. The significant presence of Jewish settlers all over what used to be historical Palestine, including in more than half of the area which is now the West Bank, makes the idea of two states which have two distinct and separate ethnic communities an impossible plan. So if one does not talk about the two-state solution as an equitable arrangement by which two independent sovereign states would live one next to the other, which is an impossible scheme, then the only way one can talk spoke about the two-state solution is the apartheid South Africa model, where you had one state and several Bantustans, protectorates, dependencies, with no independence or autonomy, and totally dependent on the goodwill and policies of the ruling regime. In this case, it would be the Jewish state.
You have spoken about a one-state solution at a memorable debate you had with former Knesset member Uri Avneri in May of 2007 in Tel Aviv, and more recently at the Trans-Arab Research Institute conference held in Boston on March 28th and 29th of this year, 2009. Could you lay out your ideas to our listeners for a single-state solution?
Yes. I divided my set of arguments in both my debate with Uri Avneri and in the speech I gave in Boston in March this year. I divided it into two groups of arguments. There are the negative and the positive arguments. We began to talk about the negative argument. This is the recognition and the realization that a two-state solution, even if one supports it, is not a feasible solution given the reality on the ground. A very short visit in the West Bank would convince, I think, even the most ardent supporter of the two-state solution that the kind of transformation on the ground that would have to take place is so huge that you have to be over-optimistic to believe that anyone on the Israeli side would ever undertake such a project. But there is also the group of arguments which I define as positive arguments, namely the ones that base the support for the one-state solution on moral grounds and not just practical grounds. And from a moral point of view, it's very clear that the two-state solution, for instance, even in its most optimistic version, does not offer any solution for the problem of the Palestinian refugees. And it is unthinkable that one could really reach a stage of reconciliation and genuine peace in Palestine without a just solution for the refugee problem, which should be based on resolution of the United Nations Resolution 194 that recognizes the unconditional right of the refugees to return. Secondly, the two-state solution, from a moral point of view, reduces Palestine geographically into mere 20% of what it is and totally exclude half of the people in the world who are Palestinians. And again, a solution, even one which would be agreed upon in the most ideal circumstances, that relates only to 20% of historical Palestine and deals or caters only with the problem of half of the Palestinian people, namely does not include the refugees or the Palestinians living in what today is pre-1967 Israel, can only be a partial agreement and can really misses the outstanding problem that lie behind what we call today the Palestine question. So these are the set of arguments. Finally, let me just say on this point that the idea of one state is not such a utopian idea because we already have a one-state solution. It's just a question of changing our dictionary and our perspective and begin to talk about the change of regime rather than the need to create new states. There is already a state and there is already one geopolitical unit which is called Israel but which is also Palestine, an apartheid, ethnic, racist state that has to be replaced by a democratic political structure. This should seem more feasible than creating out of the blue new two states.
Well, what does one say to the people who accuse those who advocate for a single state that they seek the destruction of the state of Israel?
Yes, this is a familiar counter argument. And I think it's quite bizarre that those of us who talk about the need to create a democratic state in order to offer equal rights and equal opportunities to whoever lives in Israel and Palestine, which includes, by the way, non-Jewish immigrants who came 2 days ago from Russia, to look at such a positive, humanist, universalist outlook of the need of people to share a land and to live together despite of everything that happened to the Palestinians, to look at this positive impulse as a wish to destroy anything is really totally to misunderstand intentionally misrepresent the solution. This is not to destroy the life of people who live in Israel. In fact, this is first and foremost, of course, to salvage the Palestinians from the fate of destruction, but it's also to salvage the Jews in Israel from the immoral position in which they live together today as oppressors, occupiers, and colonizers, and in fact offer them a solution in the land rather than outside the land, which is usually what anti-colonialist movement demanded from foreign settlers, was to leave and go back to their homeland. Here the idea is to a post-colonialist idea that offers an equal future to everyone, the colonized, the colonizer, the oppressor, the oppressed. This is an impulse which is totally positive and constructive, and it's only any attempt to maintain the present reality is a destructive solution, not what we are offering.
Ilan, why is it so necessary for Israel to be a state for Jews only? Is it because Jews can only feel safe with fellow Jews? And does that come from fear of all non-Jews?
It's an excellent question that I once thought that there was a simple answer to it. And I wrote once that I thought that Zionism became a movement that seeks a pure ethnic Jewish state because of the fact that it was a colonialist project, that the moment the Zionist movement opted chose Palestine as a territory in which it would fulfill its dream of a safe a haven for the Jews and a place where Jews could fulfill the dream of self-determination, I said that the moment they chose Palestine in which another people live, they became a colonialist movement and hence developed the ethnic racist ideas. I'm not sure now that this is a good enough explanation, because colonialist situation in the late 19th century did not create this kind of a totally exclusivist ideology. I think there is something deeper there about the kind of mentality that the people who came from Central and Eastern Europe had in them, maybe something that had to do with the very bizarre experience of living in ghettos and closed communities for so many years. It's a kind of a mixture of colonialism on the one hand and a very peculiar hostile attitude to anyone who is not part of your nation or religious group or ethnicity. And this is a lethal mixture, apparently, when it is developed into a takeover plan of another country. And the fact that it is allowed to continue in the 21st century is quite bewildering and amazing. If you can think about any other state in the world that would develop openly such policies and ideologies, it would be immediately excluded from what we call the group of civilized nations. Somehow it passes by as a security policy for most of your, not your listeners, I hope, but for most of the average listeners in the United States. What Israel calls a security policy is actually the continuation of that very fierce ethnic and racist ideology of having a state only for the Jews, which means, and above all, not allowing a state for the people who are the indigenous and native population of that country.
And that probably was it's encouraged by Europe's continuing guilt for everything it has done, and precipitated by the Holocaust. But another question comes up. I mean, how can Israel take its place in the community of nations if it suspects all other countries of secretly plotting to destroy it and takes preemptive military actions against them? Is that not a disastrous prescription for war everlasting?
Yes, I think that part of the problem of the way that the Zionist state became a reality was that in order to maintain this exclusivity, and because of the liberation struggle of the Palestinian people, you needed to use a lot of force, first to dispossess the people, then to make sure that they are not coming back, and they're still using a lot of force, as you know, to dispossess the Palestinians from very little that is still Palestine today, half of the West Bank and the strangulated Gaza Strip. Now, that meant that for the last 60 years of Israel's existence, the military played a dominant role in every aspect of life. And it's only when you live here, I think, you realize how dominant and prevalent is the control of the army in every aspect and every walk of life. Now, in order to continue and justify this militarization of the society, you need to convince your electorate that the most important problems of the state can only be solved by military power. And you will always need the generals to help you to survive. And for this, you produce a constant military tension, constant conflicts, in a very disastrous way. I mean, history taught us, in the case of Prussia and in the case of Sparta, that such societies eventually get to the point where they are defeated or that the generals do not deliver. And then a great disaster befalls on these societies. But as long as it seems a victorious path, then it would be very hard to demilitarize the society. And the militarization of society is a substitute for a dictatorship. You don't need to coerce people into the indoctrination. The military does it for you from a very early age in the school, through the reserve service, and through the dominant role of generals in the economy, cultural, and politics of the country.
And wouldn't you say that adding to this is the conscious and, I think, cynical way by which the government and the formal Jewish organizations outside of Israel constantly keep Jews under a perpetual state of existential fear? We saw this existential fear being played out in 1967, when it was later it was admitted that this was all manufactured, that the State of Israel was never in any danger in 1967. We saw it in the 1982 Lebanon War. We saw it in the 2006 Lebanon War, when people constantly thought that Israel was never in greater danger. And keeping people in perpetual existential fear, a state of near psychosis, it also does wonders to help the generals in their idea of security for the State of Israel through persecution of others.
Absolutely, I agree. I think, by the way, that there is something is changing in this respect, not inside, unfortunately, the Jewish society in Israel. I think this engineered psychosis is working very well. In fact, for me, one of the reasons I decided at least to live part of the time outside of this country was experiences this psychosis in 2006, where even my more open-minded friends were totally mesmerized by the military's propaganda and were seeking another war as a solution for what happened in 2006, or the lack of even one genuine moral voice when the massacre in Gaza occurred in 2009. So I'm afraid you described a very it was a very correct description for the way the psychosis still works within the Jewish society in Israel. I do think, however, that there is beginning, one can trace the beginning of change in the more progressive sections of the Jewish communities around the world, including in the United States. I was very impressed when Naomi Klein told me when she was in Gaza recently, and she had to go through the Israeli checkpoint in Erez to be allowed into Gaza. And when she came out, the commander of that checkpoint told her that the Israeli army was on high alert to retrieve her should she be kidnapped by the Hamas. She told him something that I don't think he ever heard from someone who is a North American Jew, that she felt much more secure there than she feels in his presence. And the fact that more and more American Jews of this North American Jews who are who in this generation begin to send the Israelis a very important message: you are not our insurance company. We do not rely on you in order to feel safe. In fact, quite the opposite. If we feel unsafe today as Jews, it's because of you. And I heard it also from progressive Jews in Britain and in some parts of the European continent. This is very worrying for the Israelis, but I think that the facts on the ground in a less indoctrinated environment outside of Israel are so clear that this transformation in due course, I believe, would play a very important and transformative role in changing the international status of Israel, which is, I think, one of the keys for bringing peace and reconciliation to Israel and Palestine.
I certainly agree with you that this, in due course, will change things. But, you know, long term in Palestine is maybe a month.
Yes, indeed, you're right. And the pace of destruction is faster, undoubtedly.
In your extensive travels in Israel and Palestine, have you found that most people long for normalcy above everything else? In other words, a physically safe, normal life, raising families, sending children to school, pursuing personal happiness, fulfillment of ambitions. Isn't there that feeling in Israel also of looking for normal life? And that a one-state solution would give them that.
Indeed, I would say that one finds this, first of all, this urge for normality more on the Palestinian side, because the basic normality is totally denied to them. But I found out that in the Israeli Jewish community, if you have the time and the patience to work through the walls that have been built, I am talking about ideological walls that have been built around the communities. And sorry, Sharif. Tuliani Birayon Larsot Abrit. Sorry.
Okay.
Sorry about that. That have been built around the communities, that if you succeed in penetrating through the media coverage, through the discourse of the politicians, through the messages of the educational system. And as I say, you have to be very patient with this.
That's a very thick wall to penetrate.
It's a very thick wall to penetrate. Yes, you find normal people who want normal life. But, you know, the mothers of most of the people whom I would consider my past friends, people who come from the same milieu in which I grew up in Israel, do not stop and think for one moment to what exactly do they sacrifice their children. And I keep telling them, you are doing it to maintain the empire of Israel, which is an oppressive, colonizing empire. Is this a noble goal in your eyes? And this is a non-starter, of course, for a dialogue. You need something deeper than that in order to explain to people. By the way, I think it, again, I'm optimistic in the long term. I think that young activists in the Jewish community, the most important among them is a group called New Profile, which works towards educating parents and young people. They're doing excellent job. But it's a very, very slow process, given the powers that be that confront them. But and we cannot rely on that in order to salvage the Palestinians. We need, I once talked with you, I think, in the last program, we need a very concerted and coordinated campaign of pressure, of boycott and divestment and sanctions in order to stop the destruction. But in order to build something beyond the end of occupation and the end of colonization, in order to build a joint future, we need this process of re-educating, if you want, people, liberating them from the engineered psychosis. We need these people to continue their sacred job of courageously telling people what they are, how they were engineered and how they were manipulated, and making them liberated people.
Would it be fair to say then that a single state is a workable option? But should it be the priority option to be pursued by the peace movements in the United States, Europe, Israel, and Palestine? Should it be the centerpiece rather than that two-state solution which everybody talks about?
Yes, I do think so, with one caveat, with one reservation. I do think that we should really move on and put the one state at the center. I have very little doubt or hesitation about it. However, I don't want to lose many of our good friends. Let us call them two-staters for the sake of a better term, yeah. Who are as genuine in their wish to change the reality on the ground as you and I are. And there's no need to create an artificial division and lose comrades when, anyway, not the two states, not the one state solution is on the agenda anyway. And to find a joint work, a joint agenda of working together, I think at least what we should demand and ask, that it's as legitimate to talk about a one-state solution as to be open about the possibility of a two-state solution, in order not to lose the possibility of creating a wide coalition. In a similar way that we would like all not to experience in the solidarity movement outside of Palestine the unfortunate situation we have inside, where the Fatah and the Hamas are at odds and sometimes clash even directly. I think some of the issues, such as the one state and the two states, the nature of the state, are all worthy topics that should be discussed openly, provided they do not weaken our ability to work together against a very formidable alliance of forces who want to maintain the reality as it is.
Would it be feasible to form a working group that would include Palestinians and Israelis working on the alternative solutions that would include the leaderships, especially the leadership of Palestine, as you say, but that the conflict between Fatah and Hamas is an engineered conflict, engineered by the United States and Israel. Would it be possible to form a working group that would consider both and then write its a draft of the conclusions of that working group?
Yes, I think half of the job is being done as we speak as a result of initiatives such as the conference in Boston and before that a similar conference in London and in Madrid. There is the beginning of working groups that do not only push forward the idea of a one-state solution, but also think more deeply and in a focused way on different components of such a future state. For instance, the idea of what would a constitution look like of such a state, what would an educational curriculum would look like, how do we move towards such a solution given the dominance of the two-state solution in the international arena. So I think very good people from the civil society, academics, activists and so on are engaged in such an effort as we speak, and that's a good beginning. Of course, you are asking correctly of how do we recruit the political elites. In fact, one of the speaker in the Boston conference in March 2009 made a similar comment the time has come now to try and engage directly, at least with the Palestinian political elite, mm-hmm. and talk with them about that. Yes, I think we should attempt it. It has not been attempted. I think people sort of thought anyway the elite would, political elite of the day would say, no, forget it, we are focused on the two-state solution and we don't want to think about an alternative solution. But if you hear what they say, especially in the very desperate moments when they are being rebuked by the Israelis and once again, as happens every one month or two, are taken for a ride by either the American negotiators or the Israelis interlocutors, then they say, well, we may think about the one-state solution. Yes, I think the time has come definitely to begin an open dialogue. We may have to wait a little bit before people would realize that nothing comes out from the Obama initiative. I think September is not a good month because there is this anticipated and excitement about the possible peace plan that would come out from the White House in September. I'm very skeptic about it, and I don't think there is any real peace plan coming out from the White House. But I think that unfortunately, when the realization would set in that this administration, despite its better language, if you want, in essence is not offering anything new, it would push us a step forward towards a constructive dialogue with the political elite, or it would be at least easier to start such a dialogue under these circumstances.
I would imagine that the political elite in Palestine are all very much concerned about their losing their position of influence in a single state. Would you have any final thoughts? I think this should be a topic to revisit again in the future, but would you have any final thoughts today?
Yes, I think that it's important to convey, at the risk of repeating oneself, that nothing stays as it is on the ground, and that when you're here, and most of the time I'm in England, now I'm here, and you visit the places, you see that the way we started our the talk today, we should end it. In other words, that the colonization of Palestine continues every day in Greater Jerusalem, in the Galilee, in the Nakab. People are still being, I just visited the military court a few days ago, students of the West Bank universities are being taken at the dead of night by the Israeli military, are imprisoned without trial, houses are being demolished, people are being expelled. 2 days ago, a youth, Palestinian youth, was shot. The fact that the media has lost interest in the daily business of the occupation does not mean that the daily business does not continue, and that the strategy of colonization and dispossession and ethnic cleansing does not continue. And the same sense of urgency we all heard that activists had during the massacre of Gaza should be recaptured, because the daily massacre is as bad as the brutal one that took place in 1 week or two.
Thank you so much, Professor Ilan Pape, for being our guest today.
Thank you very much, Sharif.
I'm sure we need to revisit this topic again, and I hope that you might be available again in the future. It was a pleasure to have you with us.
I certainly hope to do so. Thank you.
Thank you. And that is all we have for today. We wish our listeners a happy Labor Day weekend and look forward to having you with us next Sunday, same time. Until then, this is Sharif Fahm reminding everyone to get involved. Get involved. Palestine is in dire need for any contribution you might make. Thank you.